At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with
Genevieve Kosky,
Keith Phipps.
Tasha Robinson is at the Sundance Film Festival, spending millions on the next Spitfire grill, but she'll be back at lower altitude soon. Every week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. Today, we're looking at documentaries about two dreamers. One, an independent filmmaker from Milwaukee who's determined to make his first feature. The other, an entrepreneur from New York who's trying to stage the most exclusive high-end music festival the world has ever seen. Two inspiring tales of triumph over adversity, right, Genevieve?
Well, they definitely deliver in the adversity department, not so much in the triumph department.
But they're inspiring, right? Noble failures?
Mixed bag there too, I'm afraid. One of them is still nurturing the dream 20 years later. The other one is currently spending 6 years in federal prison.
Oof. Okay, so what do they have in common?
We'll save that question for connections, but Mark Borchardt and Billy McFarland are two unforgettable characters profiled by director Chris Smith, an independent filmmaker who's fascinated by ambitious eccentrics. Borchardt is the hero of Smith's 1999 breakthrough film, American Movie, which was supposed to be about Borchardt's efforts to make a personal film called Northwestern, but is actually about him finishing a horror short called Coven.
Genevieve, please. It's pronounced Coven. Rhymes with oven? As in, I took the cookies out of the oven? Go ahead.
Thank you. Well, Smith's new film is the Netflix documentary Fire, one of two competing documentaries about Fire Festival, a notoriously botched attempt to stage a luxury music festival on a beach in the Bahamas. The other, called Fire Fraud, is on Hulu. At the center of Fire is founder Billy McFarland, who partnered with the rapper Ja Rule to offer well-to-do millennials the opportunity to party with models in paradise and take in the music of Major Lazer, Blink-182, Migos, and other acts. Needless to say, the festival fell well short of expectations.
So this week we'll kick off our Chris Smith pairing with American Movie, a documentary about the thrilling and humbling and occasionally stupefying process of making a film. Then next week we'll bring in Fire and talk about all the things the two films have in common. Keith, I've given you one line in this script. Let's hear it.
It's all right. It's okay. There's something to live for. Jesus told me so.
Wow. First take. Cut. Print. That's a wrap.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
His whole life is making this one film.
You have 2 hours tomorrow from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. and be an extra in a film?
You get your name on the credits, man, as a producer.
And of course, there'll be a whole crowd of people here, so we gotta make like a line where people can't go. Have a hell of a lot of assistant directors saying, hey, could you step back like 5 feet? I think my mom's gonna have to end up going out in the woods.
I have my shopping to do.
Okay, you gotta spread apart that way. All of the extras have just fell through, except for Mike Shank right there.
We used to do a lot of partying together, but I don't party anymore.
Hey, Mike, make sure everyone has brown gloves.
Does everyone have brown gloves?
No, dude.
I'm broke, man. I gotta get gas tomorrow. And dude's talking about making a feature film.
The name of the film is Coven.
Coven.
Coven, that's the proper pronunciation.
No. Coven sounds like oven, man, and that's just, it doesn't work.
She wants to be in your film, Bill.
Oh my gosh.
You get your $3,000 back. It's the first line of the film, man. It's gotta be on the money.
It's all right.
Okay, I believe we can do this.
The first question we usually ask at the beginning of each Next Picture Show pairing is, what is your history with the older movie? How did it play when you first encountered it? And how does it play now? But I'm going to address that question now about American Movie, because I think when you see the film does affect your understanding of it. And for me, it's personal. American Movie premiered almost exactly 20 years ago at the Sundance Film Festival. And I premiered as a full-time film critic about 6 months after that, with a much different perspective on my chosen field that I have now. As a young adult, it's easy to see American Movie as the inspiring story of a filmmaker who's chasing his dream and simply won't take no for an answer. Mark Borchardt is the ultimate outsider, a blue-collar guy from Milwaukee who's determined not to lead an ordinary life. Perhaps the most comparable path to success for Borchardt would be George Romero, a Pittsburgh native who made a name for himself with the ultra-low-budget black-and-white zombie film Night of the Living Dead. As it happens, Borchardt is a huge George Romero fan, having made Romero-inspired horror shorts on Super 8mm with titles like The More the Scarier and The More the Scarier 3. And as American Movie opens, Borchardt is 3 years into making Coven, a black-and-white shocker that's still an edit and a few reshoots away from being finished. The film is ostensibly about the making of Borchardt's first feature film, Northwestern, a production that he's determined to get off the ground, despite not having a finished script or anywhere near the resources to make it happen. Outside of a few production meetings, however, we never see a single frame of Northwestern get shot. In fact, we never even find out what it's about. What filmmaking we do get to see are the reshoots on Coven, which Borchardt hopes will attract enough attention and VHS sales to get him the money he needs for his magnum opus. In the meantime, he's working odd jobs as a newspaper delivery man and as a janitor at a cemetery, hanging out with his buddy Mike Shank, drinking a lot, and sorting through second and third notices on bills that are piling up. Hollywood is still a steep climb away. And yet, if the title weren't already taken by another great making-of documentary, American Movie could be called Burden of Dreams. As a middle-aged person watching the film, I found myself more sensitive to the practical consequences of Borchardt's ambitions. He's a father of young children. What's his relationship with them? How well is he supporting them? What burden are they accepting on his behalf? He's roped in actors and crew members with his pitch, but what do his broken promises mean for them? And how are we to take his relationship with Uncle Bill? On the one hand, he seems to be the only person genuinely caring enough to withstand Bill's surliness and look after him on occasion, even giving him a bath. On the other, Bill is the one solid source of money he could tap, and he's aggressive about doing so. Is he a good nephew? Or is he just trying to separate a demented old man from his nest egg? These are complicated questions, and they reveal American Movie to be about so much more than a film about filmmaking, though it's often funny as hell in that respect. It's about the calculations all of us make as adults between pursuing our dreams and acknowledging our responsibilities. Mark Borchardt is an extreme case in that he's willing to dodge or deny reality in the pursuit of greatness. When I first saw an American Movie in 1999, I was fortunate enough to have achieved a dream that I had carried since I was 16 years old and working in a movie theater. 20 years later, I'm still more or less on the same track, but with a much more practical sense of what the job is and what larger responsibilities I have to those closest to me. Because whatever dreams I've had and have, they're not entirely my own.
This is ridiculous. We started May 94, man. We've got every f-stop known to man in the film. And right now, we got to take action, man. We got to go out to that field, put those scarecrows in on a killer slant. You know, they've been there for years. The farm's burnt down. It's going to be the opening shots for Coven, you know?
And what is Coven?
Coven's a 35-minute direct market thriller film shot on 16mm black and white reversal. It's an alcoholic man compelled to go to this group meeting by his one and only friend left. But they're not that helpful, the group, you know? You know about the group thing?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's what we're doing a film on. Coven, man. We got to get this sucker done, though. Seriously. Last night, man, I was so drunk, I was calling Morocco, man. Calling, trying to get to Hotel Hilton at Tangiers in Casablanca, man. That's pathetic, man. Is that what you want to do with your life? Suck down peppermint schnapps and try to call Morocco at 2 in the morning? That's senseless. But that's what happens, man.
Okay, so you've heard me talk about this question. So how did this movie play for you when you saw it, and how does it play for you now?
It played great then, it plays great now. And while I've always been of the mind that the criticism was lobbied at, it's sort of exploiting Borchardt and making fun of him, but I really never thought that then, and I think even less so now. It plays very even-handed to me, and I mean, full disclosure, I interviewed Chris Smith and I kind of got to know him a little bit at the time. And his take was always that he was a filmmaker trying to figure out how to do what he was doing. And he was just making another documentary about another filmmaker in the same situation. Obviously, you know, when you find a colorful character who's going to make for an interesting film. But I think there's a certain amount of respect and interest and concern to the filmmaking that never plays as condescending to me.
Yeah, I've seen this movie before, but it was less than 10 years ago. It was while I was at the AV Club, and I think I have probably less of a personal connection to this film than both of you do for various reasons. But like Keith, I liked it then and I liked it now. Borchardt is just very charismatic in a very specific way, and I think that is what keeps it from feeling exploitative, like you say, Keith. He's just like the kind of character that pulls you into his orbit, whether you like actually like him or not, or want to hang out with him. Like he's just like such a curiosity of a person, which makes for a very compelling documentary that is also really sad. Like I think you were kind of circling this a little bit in your keynote, Scott, but you know, I definitely came away from it this time feeling a lot sadder than I remember the first time, when I think I maybe approached it a little more, you know, glibly or snidely, as, you know, look at this weirdo, kind of a almost Tommy Wiseau type figure, you know, but kind of looking at it now in the context of his family and the people around him and his adult obligations, and Mike Shank, who is just such a interesting counterpoint to everything that is going on with Mark here. It's hard to come away from it feel like I feel sad, not because Mark still hasn't gotten to make Northwestern. I just like I feel sad that I don't want to say I feel sad that this is his life, because that's condescending, but just like I feel bad about like all the circumstances that are in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, when he's battling against the forces that would face even right. someone of immense talent working from the Midwest, you know.
Or someone who wasn't trying to make a movie. Like, that's kind of what I mean, is like, independent of the movie making aspect and him like knocking to realize his dream, just like there's so much in his life that is like relatable on a just sort of a human level, like the financial struggles, the relationship difficulties, the family tension and strife, you know, there's a lot there that is very recognizable on a human level. The movie almost seems more of a frame around all of that to me.
Yeah, and I think to kind of continue what Scott was saying is, as you get older, even if you're living a happy life, you realize that life is, after a certain point, its doors closing and opportunity is just not being there. Mm-hmm. And you know, he's high, early 30s.
Right around 31.
So yeah, it really is sort of like the moment of realization that it may be too late for him, you know? And
he doesn't have that realization.
Have that realization, or he's denying it. Denial through the entire movie that it's not going to happen. And I think you're right, though, also, that I mean, you know, not to get too autobiographical, but, you know, it's easy to see him as like, oh, that's kind of funny that he's also a dad and he's trying to do all this. And now it's like, wait, be a dad, you know? That's more important than your movie.
One of the things I found interesting about this film, watching at this time, was how long Smith, and I guess this is a good time to also credit Sarah Price, who is his collaborator.
It's credited as a film by Chris Smith and Sarah Price.
Yeah, there's no actual directorial credit. It's just a film by the two of them. But anyway, I find it very interesting that they choose to wait so long to introduce the fact that he has children. Mm-hmm. You know, you spend a lot more time with his obsession with this film, and then it's like all of a sudden, oh, and also there's kids.
I think it's very good at, throughout the film, introducing like new wrinkles like that, too.
Yeah. Also kind of the strife with his parents, that's also kind of comes later. So that's kind of what I mean about the making a movie element seeming more like a framing device within this like portrait of a kind of ordinary life in a lot of ways.
Well, let me suggest another motive too on Christmas part, is that all of these elements are on the periphery because they are on the periphery of Borchardt's life too. Like, he is not minding these elements that would be very central. I mean, being a father of all these children would be pretty central to your experience as a person, usually, if you're not trying to chase a stream as he is. And so you have some very important elements that he's kind of pushing off to the side or denying. And I think the film does a nice job of reflecting that, because I think there's another film you could make that would just be about all the areas of his life that are going untended. But we don't get that movie. We get this one, which is great. And so you can kind of then go back to it and think about, oh, what's being forgotten here as he's pursuing the dream. But I think there's the other thing about this film that's so And I guess this is where it gets inspiring or semi-inspiring is that I think everybody does have, people have dreams. I mean, people do want to, achieve something grand with their life. Even if there are other lives or younger lives they're responsible for, it's just to actually table that dream as the entire universe is telling Mark Borchardt to do. It's a painful thing to do, and for him to kind of carry on despite that is heroic in its way.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that I personally relate it to also is as a Midwesterner and as someone who doesn't necessarily have a lot of connections, I never really wanted to make a movie. I was always kind of happier doing this, but even like writing about movies just seemed like an impossible thing. That's something that someone from where I came from, nobody else interested around me in culture writing or culture in general. A lot of people aren't just interested in culture in general where I grew up. It was, things seemed out of reach. And I found that very relatable to him. I don't know that he was, the next Spielberg denied or anything, but he never really got a chance to find out for himself.
Well, there's also the matter of scale. I mean, I don't really get the sense that Mark Borchardt is dying to jet off to Hollywood to become, the next Spielberg. He wants to make a movie. There's all this wonderful footage of, the Super 8mm films he made just driving around with his buddies, and causing mayhem that teenagers do, and his desire to make a movie seems very pure in a lot of ways. He just wants it to be out there, he wants to sell enough VHS copies to make another movie. It's a somewhat modest ambition within the very large scope that making any movie is, but within movie making generally, I think what he wants to do is fairly modest.
The other point I think about him too is that he isn't Tommy Wiseau. He has limitations to his talent, but
and to his finances.
And his finances, but he's got an eye. He's film literate. He certainly knows technically what he's doing. He's not that bad a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. And it brings me to that, again, to that point about at the time where critics were sort of complaining that the film was being condescending towards him. It's like, if you've ever been on a low budget shoot or a student production or a production of the scale that of Borchardt's, I mean, this kind of DIY craziness is the norm. It's like, it's part of the process of learning. And I think everyone is having fun with that. The film is laughing with it, and it should. I mean, can you imagine getting all of that footage of the cabinet cabinet scene, and then deciding, if I put it in there, people think. I mean, that's gold. That's solid gold. You're putting that in the movie unless you're a crazy person.
The whole condescension thing, just to dwell on it a little longer, it reminds me that when we did Roger and Me for our Michael Moore pairing, that also came up then, is whether he was being condescending toward the rabbit lady or, anyone else in Flint. And I kind of wonder if the whole condescension criticism is maybe just coming from a place of elitism to begin with,
It's dated, maybe. Maybe it just was a complaint that people had. It's something people like to complain about at the time, and now it seems like, what were people talking about?
Yeah, that could be it too. But
non-Midwestern folk, that's the problem.
in both the case of Roger and Me and here, it's filmmakers who are filming in their own space, in their own world. Chris Smith wasn't really an outsider, coming into this world, and Michael Moore was returning to his hometown. I think there has to be an exploitative element to claim condescension that I don't think either of these films, that I don't see in either of these films.
To circle back to a point that Keith made earlier, Chris Smith wasn't anything at this point. The way this film came together was that he was at an editing bay at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, cutting together his first movie called American Job. And that's when he kind of, Borchardt was working on his film, and there was all sorts of, Iraq. I don't think Borchardt can go anywhere without there being a certain amount of noise.
Him and his four kids tagging along, sleeping in the editing bay.
Exactly, right. And so there's plenty of that. But Chris Smith at that point was a Midwesterner from Okemos, Michigan, who traveled around and lived in different places, who would scrape together a very small budget and asked a lot of favors to get, American Job, which is a fantastic film, off the ground. But it wasn't off the ground yet. And when he finished cutting American Job, it didn't, it got rejected from Sundance. It got rejected from a bunch of festivals before it finally kind of found a couple of people who recognized how good it was, and then it found its way out. So
it's not available anywhere.
It's not.
It's really good.
It is really good. It's one I hope, like, Christmas starting to work a lot more now, mm-hmm. and maybe that will inspire American Job to come out. I think it was like, was it a special feature on the American Movie DVD?
No.
That would have been pretty special, because that movie almost is nearly as good as American Movie, in my opinion. But
yeah,
but
there's a great scene. I've spent a summer working light industrial work, which is
I was thinking of you watching the scene.
Yeah, and there's a scene there. I worked at various machine presses, that kind of thing, but at a plastic box factory, worst of all. But you kind of just have to adjust your body to the rhythms of the machine. You're like, the part they could not automate is what you are. So like, you take the in my case, you had to take the plastic boxes out and like shave off the sides. But there's equivalent, the hero of that movie has an equivalent job, and it's like, you know, in the time it takes for the machine to spit out whatever it is he's working on, that time's your own. And he's like, you can read a book or whatever. So there's this scene of him like trying to read a novel in like 30 seconds at a time in like his downtime. While it's definitely, you know, like American Movie, it benefits from someone knowing what he's talking about, you know, and knowing the world he's trying to depict.
And knowing labor.
Yes.
Which is a part of this movie, too, and which is, we'll get to later, is a part of Fire. I mean, like this is about jobs that have to be done. I mean, you get plenty of footage of Borchardt working a newspaper route or, you know, working at the cemetery.
Taking down 1,400 American flags.
Taking down all those flags. Yeah, so I mean, that is, you know, he has to, you know, scrape at these low-wage jobs to put together what money he can. I mean, he's swimming in debt, maybe to swim in debt a little bit less. An American Job is all about that. It's all about minimum wage jobs that this guy goes from one to another. I mean, there's a scene with the box factory. I think it is a box factory.
I forget what it was.
He breaks the machine. And he just walks off.
Yeah.
He comes in the next day and he has to meet with the boss. And the boss has him sit in his chair. Did you remember this? The boss has him sit in his chair and tell him what he'd do in his situation. It's like, well, I guess I have to let you go. Yep. Yep. You're on your way out.
But, speaking of movies that people can't see.
Yes.
Have either of you seen any more of Coven than what appears?
Yeah,
in
it's on
this
the, it's
movie?
On the DVD.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting. What you see in the movie is actually really, the shots you see in American Movie are actually really promising looking. I
mean, yeah, like is what we see? It seems like we're seeing the opening credits,
yeah,
and then it kind of skips
it
around.
When I did this, but yeah. And it's not great, but it's not. I mean, it's like a lot of.
It looks like a really good student film.
Yeah, exactly. Like a lot of other low budget horror films from the time. Like I can see him, you know, it's kind of thing you maybe, you know, hardcore horror fans would buy on VHS and from back of Fangoria or wherever he's trying to sell.
Yeah, well, this seems to be like operating in your milieu or what used to be your milieu. like is his plan to sell 300 VHS copies of Coven at all realistic?
I mean, probably not.
Like quality aside, is something like at that scale going to sell 3,000 VHS copies?
If I remember
copies?
Correctly, the American Movie website kept track of how many VHS copies he sold, and like even with the publicity of the film itself, I don't think they were close to meeting.
He was
goal.
On. I watched because I did this whole feature on Chris Smith, and so I ended up watching. There were three appearances by Mark Borchardt on Letterman.
Mm-hmm.
He was just kind of this funny character that Letterman liked to bring on and. Well, make
condescend to
exactly yeah. Now there you might have an argument, but there was a thing where he this obviously the publicity for this film did gave Coven sales a huge boost they would not otherwise have
yeah
had.
But not I don't know if even with that I'm not sure they
made enough
goals,
okay but I think I agree with Keith in terms of the quality of the film. It's not a great movie but it's not terrible, you know?
Is it promising though?
I wouldn't necessarily even go that far, yeah. but it's not garbage. It's not like, again, it's not Tommy Wiseau. I mean, this is somebody who has a sensibility and has an eye, but is not hugely sophisticated a filmmaker either.
Yeah, I mean that's I don't want to like overdo the comparison to Tommy Wiseau, but like they are kind of interesting analogous figures working at more or less the same time. So perhaps it's inevitable, but like Borchardt seems like he at least has a pretty good handle on the craft of filmmaking, and if not necessarily the ability to do the work, an awareness of the work that needs to be done. but perhaps not the level of vision or ambition in terms of the actual content of his film that a madman like Tommy Wiseau might have.
He has money, too. I mean, exactly. I mean, that's the difference, right?
Or training, too. I mean, someone who didn't necessarily get the chance to learn the skills. He's kind of, I'm sure he picked them up on his own and
for sure.
Read all those books that he's got in his room, too.
We got every F-stop known to man in this film.
Yeah, I mean, he knows about F-stop. There's no way Tommy Wiseau knows a damn thing about F-stop or how to work, you know, in an editing bay and... I mean, he was cutting on film, so that's a huge skill. But one of the things I wanted to get to before because we're still deep into this, I wanted to talk about the relationships in the film because there are so many memorable characters. Two in particular, Mike Shank and Uncle Bill. So maybe we break them down one by one. What do you make of these relationships?
Shank's such a mystery, right?
Well, I feel like both relationships are really tied up in a lot of ways, not solely, but in a lot of ways with Mark's relationship with alcohol and partying. Mm. One of the things that I had either missed before or forgotten is the scenes of Mark like feeding Bill alcohol, getting him drunk. And that is like, he's clearly not at a stage in his life where that is at all beneficial to him. And with Mike Shank, Mark seems to have a very uneasy relationship with Mike's sort of newfound sobriety, such as it is, you know. And there's at the premiere, there's that weird moment where he's like on stage thanking people and he says something like, yeah, don't drink, drinking's bad, to Mike. He just like calls him out and makes some sort of weird comment about drinking. And that complicated those relationships to me in a really interesting way. And because Mark's drinking, partying, whatever you want to call it, is sort of like a foundational aspect of a lot of this movie. Like, I mean, several people say in the movie that he has some sort of problem and we see him drinking while he's filming and stuff. You know, he's perhaps functional, but it's, you know, maybe a bigger part of his life than it needs to be. And in these two cases, maybe a little bigger part of his relationships than it needs to be.
Yeah, I mean, there's a scene in here on Super Bowl Sunday where he's quite messy.
That's so ugly. And yeah. That's a bottoming out scene. And I think that whole monologue about not working in a factory, it's like sad, but it's like that's, you know, there's condescending there too, that he thinks he's better than the working class people around him, you know. And it's a rough scene to watch, you know?
Yeah, no, it's real. I mean, I you know, in terms of just the way that dynamic plays out though, I mean, Borchardt, and maybe this is true of real life but also on screen, is just you have Borchardt who does all the talking, and you have Shank who's passive and kind of this pleasant presence that he like, that
except for that scene where he's talking about his acid/PCP overdose, whatever. Like, that is a wild monologue, man.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
I have more stories like that.
Yeah,
too.
I got more.
Oh my god!
The big old, like, totally benign smile on his face.
I love the score that he does for the film too. That works out so well.
Yeah,
that's so smart to incorporate that. It just, you know, really just woven into the fabric of the movie.
Even if it sounds
music.
Like Sabbath.
Yeah, well, but of course, maybe a more troubled relationship is that relationship to Uncle Bill, because I think there's argument that you could make that Mark is Uncle Bill's, is the only one who really is looking after Uncle Bill and cares about Uncle Bill.
But is he doing a very good job?
Maybe not that good
a
job.
It's fully monitored. Or what it was the phrase he used.
When he was in the bath?
Yeah, it's fully monitored. Yeah, he's doing the monitoring.
Well,
oh,
like,
I am.
Even just like Uncle Bill's trailer, like that, like, you know.
He's a hoarder.
Yeah, but I don't know. I am only willing to extend Borchardt a certain amount of leeway in terms of the care he provides Uncle Bill, because I am of the opinion that it's not necessarily coming from a pure-hearted place, and the sort of half-heartedness with which he does his caregiving reflects that.
But even like giving him a bath, I mean, that he doesn't do that perfectly.
They're also both wasted when it happens.
Well, yeah.
You know,
though, I mean, that's still not a, you know,
yep.
giving an old man a bath is
an old man with a gnarly toenail
is not, well, that not somebody, not something that you would necessarily want to do. And he's out there doing it. And I think they seem to enjoy each other. And I mean, Bill likes getting the attention that he gets from Mark, and he seems to be at least semi aware of Mark's ulterior motives too. and likes to shoot him down on occasion. I don't know. I mean, you're leading pretty heavily towards this is an exploitative.
It's so hard to say because Uncle Bill is clearly, you know, mentally deteriorating over the course of this film, you know, one of our last scenes with him, I mean, there's several scenes where he, you know, the subtitles just go like gibberish, you know, or he's sing-songing, you know, he's not fully engaging in conversations at this point. But like, there's a scene where, you know, Mark's just yammering about something or other with the film and Uncle Bill's just like, is it time to eat? It's 4:30. Is it time to eat? You know, and they're just, to me, he seems not really interested in anything that Mark is doing with the movie as much as he is in just like having anyone around. Mm-hmm. I don't particularly see a lot of affection toward Mark coming from him, but
He did leave him a big chunk of cash to finish the movie.
Yeah.
Or to start the movie or something.
Well, I do wonder at what point Bill like made that will and what awareness Mark had that he had this money coming to him, you know, because Bill died very shortly after this movie wraps, like a matter of a couple months, I think, you know. So presumably he already had a will in place. Although who knows, maybe it was just a scrap of paper in his trailer. I mean,
he does literally take Uncle Bill to the bank.
That's true.
But
yeah.
An account. So
yeah.
So there is a strong effort to separate him from his money. You have the same mind on Uncle Bill?
I mean, I think the lines can get blurry. Maybe there's some real fondness there too. But whatever fondness is also kind of tied into the fact that he has the money to not fund it, I guess, but at least help it along.
I take it as genuine. I do. I mean, yeah. I think it's right in the middle there.
It's very optimistic of you, Scott.
These scenes between him and Uncle Bill, he jokes around and it's, I think they enjoy each other. I mean,
he gets more warmth from Uncle Bill than he does from his brothers. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. That one, one of his brothers is absolutely tortures him in those interview sequences.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. That's a whole interesting aspect too, his parents and their separation, which isn't dealt with too much, but his mother kind of going out on shoots with him and stuff and filming by the camera. Another great bit with her shooting framing him. That is wonderful stuff.
But that is actually maybe the moment I like Mark the most in this movie. Just because like you can feel the frustration coming off him, but also just the desire to do this, to make this happen. But it's like tempered with like he's talking to his mom, you know, and he does, you know, have a certain amount of respect for his mom, arguably not enough, but that's another conversation. But just like watching him in that frame, just having his will to do this like sucked out of him, but just like holding on, he's like, I'm gonna get through this, I'm gonna do it, I'm not gonna yell at my mom, and we're gonna get this shot. It feels like the best expression of the Mark Borchardt character to me.
I mean, I think he loves them. I mean, I think he loves his mom and he loves Mike Shank and he loves Uncle Bill, and that comes through in their rapport on occasion, or often, even in some cases. If Mark Borchardt were an intolerable person to be around, then none of what he even accomplishes would have been possible, because everyone is drawn in by him and he has that charisma and he jokes around a lot and he's he enjoys people, and it's just, he's not a monster.
That one actor,
I was gonna say,
the one who's like, well, I usually have to give like sort of a hard out so I can get out at a specific time, but I know it's just really important to him, so I kind of try to balance those two things.
And that's the guy who got his head smashed through a cabinet over and over again, right? I mean, like clearly there has to be something to Mark Borchardt to inspire that sort of devotion.
Filmmaking, that's what it is. So many memorable scenes and set pieces in this film. I would like to hear from you all what your favorite moment is in American Movie.
I think this one thing I noticed this time, just like a little shot where he is vacuuming the mausoleum and it just kind of gets the cord caught around one of the flowers and kind of has to like whip it off. And just like this little moment that they throw in there, but it's sort of a kind of telling of his existence at that time too. But in terms of the big scenes, I'm always a sucker for you know, in documentary or narrative film, of the scene that's just not working, and it's going Uncle Bill saying mm-hmm. that line over and over again with increasing resentment. And when you see that moment in the actual premiere of the film, it's like, well, okay, they got an okay. They probably got the best line reading they could out of him, you know?
Yeah, no, I was really happy that they opted to show us the end result of that, because I think that is the standout scene, mm-hmm. or at least in contention for it. And it would have been cruel to deny us, you know, seeing what actually came of it. Yeah. So that was going to be my pick too. But as for a small moment, it's at the beginning when he's like going through his stack of bills, and like the kicker of it is, kick the ass, I got a MasterCard. Yes. Somebody gave me a MasterCard. And I also like Mike Shank and the other guy, I forget his name, explain, explaining what happened to the flyers, like, or just like attempting to hang up the flyers. Like, it takes like two of them to scotch tape a flyer in the middle of a giant plate glass window. It's amusing to me.
And for as much as we established that, you know, he's a competent-ish filmmaker, I don't know that you actually need to drag someone through puddles to get the sound of someone being dragged through puddles. You can probably find a way to fake that.
So some of those filmmaking scenes are so good. Like, you see him, dude, trying to record sound where there are no birds. Like, no sound whatsoever. That's beautiful stuff. And I really like the scene of him and Mike Shank framed in front of the junkyard, and him talking about, you know,
calling Morocco.
Is this what you want to do with your life? Suck down peppermint schnapps and call Morocco at two in the morning. That's good. That's wonderful, wonderful stuff. But I mean, the cabinet scene to me is just, to go with the obvious, I mean, that is a wonderful sequence. And again, as I said before, I mean, it is not, you know, I mean, they don't have a special effects crew, you know, they don't have a breakaway cupboard or anything. And so what they're doing, it's not stupid, but it's not as dumb as it seems. It's just like, okay, we're going to put scores in this thing, and he's going to hit it with his head, and it's going to break and have the effect it's going to have. But
and at least he apologized. At least he was like, I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry you went through that.
He's like, oh, no. He tries to punch it, and he can't get his fist through. Oh. That's good. That's filmmaking, you know? I mean, that is, whether you're, you know, Werner Herzog or Mark Borchardt. I mean, who knows if Borchardt had Herzog's resources? Who knows what would have happened in that career?
He could have a documentary on Netflix by now.
All right. We'll talk more about American Movie in connection with Christmas' latest film, Fire, next week. But for now, we'll move on to feedback. Now it's time for feedback, when our listeners weigh in with their responses to recent episodes and anything else in the world of film. Usually our feedback is related to one pairing or another, but we do ask for anything else in the world of film too, so we're excited when we get something more random. Like this one from Adam, who wants to pull back the curtain on our pairing process. Keith?
Adam writes, "Hey, Next Picture Gang. At the start of every year, I like to set a movie-based resolution to undertake. Last year, I tried to watch every Best Picture winner in chronological order. I didn't quite finish it, but maybe I'll go back to it one day if someone tells me I've really learned something from Driving Miss Daisy." For 2019, I figured it would be a good time to go through the Dissolve's Movie of the Week list. That got me thinking about the process, always a favorite topic of mine to think about, of how you went about picking movies to write about and discuss on for that site, and how it's similar to different from the behind-the-scenes discussions you have picking movies for the podcast.
Well, first of all, a disclaimer, because, you know, we do have some listeners who came to us post the Dissolve.
That's
so the Dissolve was the movie site that we all ran for two glorious years, and we had a Movie of the Week feature where we would just pick a movie and do several pieces on it, and that is the format that inspired the Next Picture Show to a certain extent. So, but to the point of this question, I mean, the obvious difference is that we were only picking one movie for Movie of the Week back at the Dissolve, and we, for the most part, did not give too much consideration to contemporary reference points, you know, like our first one was, what, Repo Man, I think, or something, because we, you know, so with Movie of the Week, it was frequently a lot more just because, You know, we occasionally did like theme months or stuff like that, or, you know, inspired by something that was coming out. But for the most part, it was just a movie that one of us wanted to write about.
Something we thought we can go deep with. Yeah, I think I picked Repo Man because I wanted to do something punk, because we were going to be, we were going to have that independent attitude.
Yep.
We did.
It worked out great for us. For a little while.
But yeah, I think it was more a matter of, we didn't do a lot of shooting down, but I think we tried to, I think we were a little more esoteric early on. I think after a while we realized we should probably give, you know, maybe not the most obscure things in the world. I love that we did A Moment of Innocence by Mohsen Mahmoudov. But yeah, I think we didn't necessarily pick up readers that way.
It's a balance, though.
I know, exactly.
We had, the process really was, there was a rotation.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so we would say, hey, it's you're up to write the keynote for the week, and so what are some films that you're thinking about, and then that would be the process. So it was individually based. Then we also would maybe think about the secondary pieces that we'd be writing along with the main piece, and whether and how to come together on all that.
I mean, there was times we broke off into A teams and B teams, so we could do 2 weeks at once, and like one team tackled one film, and the other team tackled the other. Then we had it all in the back, and we were very efficient. It was good.
Yeah.
Well, and similar to how it is with the Next Picture Show, I very rarely took point on any movies of the week because I was dealing with behind the scenes stuff, and it was harder for me to do it, which is also the case.
You did some.
I did Clueless. That was
a good one.
Yeah. I think I did Pinocchio too. But my point being is that movie of the week was, the selections were made by who, like he said, whoever was up in the rotation. And we maintain that a little bit here. You know, we take into account who is up in the host rotation and sort of defer to them a little more, but it is a much more collective process, I think.
Because it involves a fair amount of commitment for not huge profits for any of us.
For not getting paid.
So we should all be enjoying, you know, we should all at least enjoy the process.
Yes.
Yeah. That, well, and it's also, of course, with this, always pegged to the new film. Always having to think about what's the new film that we should be talking about, and then we have to think about what we do before that. That was before that. So, so that's different. And we were remarkably arbitrary about what we would choose at for movie of the week. Sometimes we would have theme months, or if it was summer or something, we do like a blockbuster month or something like that. But
in the middle of Man versus Nature month when Grizzly Man was our last.
Yeah, I know. We were supposed to do a back and forth on that, and
I think I still have the draft of our Grizzly Man forum somewhere.
Well, my keynote's up there if you want to read it.
We got that far.
But I
never had to write my Into the Wild keynote. That was going to be the next one.
Okay.
So.
And I never finished my Tangerine review. I only wrote one paragraph, and then the axe fell.
Got depressing.
So depressing.
Thanks, Adam.
Good movie, though.
Yeah. Seriously, thanks, Adam.
Scott's review is good movie.
Yeah, good one. Well, I really want to just to make one last point. This was a site where a lot of people got paid and was expected to make a profit, and we did A Moment of Innocence. I just want to make sure that you're all aware of the fact that we were rebellious, or that, or follow our instincts. I should say rebellious, but we followed our instincts and tried to do a lot of things like that weren't chasing clicks by any stretch of the imagination.
We could get sidetracked with this, but I think everyone involved in this podcast has struggled a bit as you know, online media has gotten so click obsessed, and like if there's the mentality that's taken over is like, if what you're publishing isn't getting the maximum number of viewers why are you doing it, you know? And it's you know, those of us like doing nichier things, those of us that kind of grew up, you know, reading about entertainment because the thrill of discovery and learning things that you didn't know about and kind of going down like strange side paths. I'm not sure the internet media right now is that hospitable to that. I'm always waiting for that to turn around. In the meantime,
we're trying to maintain it a little bit here.
Yes,
you know,
exactly,
we do it. You know, for as many superhero movies as we've done recently, we do some forays into some more niche movies. I think American movie qualifies.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. It's not a grabby.
And nobody's talking about this fire these fire festival documentaries. But you know, and also this is we're setting our own course. So if anything happens to the Next Picture Show, we're going to be the ones to make that decision, not somebody else. So speaking of blockbusters and superhero movies,
yeah,
Genevieve, our next piece of feedback is very specific. It's from a listener who wants to clarify one of the spider people featured in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Genevieve?
Dickinson writes, "Hello, your friendly neighborhood internet pedant here. I just wanted to give a minor correction concerning Penny Parker's radioactive spider-bitten status. She indeed was bitten, as she very quickly explained during her origin story montage. The bite psychically linked her to the spider, which is partly what allows her to pilot the SPDR suit with such mastery, and also why the spider has to be the brains of the suit. In the scene where they all get the spidey sense, she clearly exhibits it. This is all in keeping with her comics origins as an homage to the many giant robot anime shows. Dead father, secretly a robot piloting superhero, aunt and uncle, you know the ones, secretly scientists who built said robot, and now telling young orphan Penny she's the only one who can take the mantle as the robot can only be piloted by those with her family's genetics. Oh, but first please give your consent to let this radioactive spider bite you so you can form a psychic bond and also become best friends." All right, so that is the Penny Parker origin story. Keith, did you have any of that background knowledge?
No, I didn't actually. I meant to go deeper into the Penny Parker stuff, but I haven't gotten around to it just yet. But that's good. It's good to know.
She was a fun person.
Some good information on the whole gallery of spider people. Maybe the least talked about, but it's good to know. And maybe future Spider-Verse movies we'll get into it more.
Maybe. I don't know. Do we think we're going to get more Spider-Verse movies? We were pretty bullish on them when we recorded
we will, because it was really great, and it's winning lots of awards.
Mm-hmm.
It's been successful at the mm-hmm. box office, and I think it's one of those things that people will continue to embrace as they experience it, because it's obviously pretty awesome.
Yeah. As evidenced by the fact that we're still getting feedback about it. So thank you, Dickinson, for your pedantry. We appreciate it.
So we always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations so we can feature your response on a future episode or post it on Facebook for discussion. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In part two, we'll pack our bags and take a private jet to Pablo Escobar's private island for an exclusive look at the Netflix documentary Fire. Look for that Tuesday, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher of choice. Find us at nextpictureshow.net, follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow, and follow us on Twitter at nextpicturepod so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, suck down some peppermint schnapps and call Morocco at 2 a.m.